Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The sound of democracy in Iraq. 6,000 candidates vying for 325 seats. An election that is not preordained. In the Middle East, that's something to crow about.
By any measure, this was an important milestone in Iraqi history. Dozens of parties and coalitions fielded thousands of parliamentary candidates, men and women. Ballots were cast at some 50,000 voting booths. And in a strong turnout, millions of Iraqis exercised their right to vote with enthusiasm and optimism.
But wait a minute. The election was marred by violence. And last time Iraqis voted, it nearly triggered a civil war. A hopeful yet fragile moment in Iraq. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning to you. Monday, March 8th. I'm Miles O'Brien in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning. Thanks for coming in, Miles. Let's check in on the top headlines this morning. As we've been saying, Iraqis are moving forward after yesterday's elections, removing campaign posters and burying those who died in the day's violence. Officials have begun counting the votes, but say it will be a few days before the first results are released. President Obama says Iraq still has a lot of work to do.
We know that there will be very difficult days ahead in Iraq. There will probably be more violence, but like any sovereign, independent nation, Iraq must be free to chart its own course.
The election is a key test of whether Iraq has a stable future and will also determine the timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops.
For more on the Iraqi election, we're joined now by Anthony Shadid, reporter for our partner, The New York Times in Baghdad. Anthony, you've been there a long time. Is this a hopeful moment for the country?
No, I think it's a hopeful moment and also an unsettling moment. There's a sense here that it's already the day after. And I think the prevailing mood that in Iraq, at least, the day after may prove far more precarious than we've already gone through.
And, of course, this starts the clock on the expected withdrawal of U.S. combat forces.
That's right. And I think the withdrawal does seem to be on course. In fact, I think when you talk to U.S. officials, the sense of that withdrawal, the timetable of it is going to change in any marked way. It's pretty unlikely. You know, everyone's bracing for what is going to be a months-long process to form a new government. It's going to be a difficult process. People are predicting violence, negotiations that could easily lead to one party walking out. But in terms of the timetable itself of an American withdrawal, that one seems almost a foregone conclusion.
Anthony Shadid with The New York Times. Stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates is in Afghanistan this morning. He'll meet with President Karzai and NATO commanders to review plans for a major U.S.-led offensive into the Taliban heartland of Kandahar. Here at home, some sobering news from the Congressional Budget Office. It says if President Obama's budget for next year were put into effect as proposed, it'll add an additional $10 trillion to the deficit over the next decade.
The Department of Education is taking a deeper look at civil rights issues in the nation's schools. The agency will focus on programs for immigrant students learning English and providing equal access to college prep courses. Education Secretary Arnie Duncan will outline the department's plan in a speech later today in Selma, Alabama, marking the 45th anniversary when civil rights marchers were beaten there on the day known as Bloody Sunday. And it was a big night for the Hurt Locker at the Oscars. It took home Best Picture and Best Director for Kathryn Bigelow, the first woman to win the directing award.
There's no other way to describe it. It's the moment of a lifetime.
Sandra Bullock won Best Actress. Monique won for Best Supporting Actress for her portrayal of a terrifying mother in Precious. Other winners include Jeff Bridges in Crazy Heart and Christopher Waltz for Inglourious Basterds. Avatar came in with 9 nominations, took home 3 Oscars for art direction and visual effects.
Looking at the markets, the Dow will start at 10,566, the S&P at 1,138, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,326. We're going to be talking all this week about genius, and we're asking you today, who's a genius in your life and what makes them a genius? Give us a call at 877-8-MINDTAKE or post to the site, thetakeaway.org. More in Iraq in a moment.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Welcome back. I'm Miles O'Brien in for John Hockenberry. It's the day after the parliamentary election in Iraq. The tough job of forming an effective government lies ahead, as does the withdrawal of U.S. combat forces. The Obama administration has vowed there will only be 50,000 U.S. combat troops, or actually troops in an advisory role, by the end of August. It's unclear what those troops will leave behind. Could it be a real democracy, a model for the Middle East? Anthony Shadid, New York Times reporter, joins us now from Baghdad. He spent election day in the city of Fallujah. Anthony, first of all, just set the scene for us. What did you see there yesterday?
You know, in Fallujah, as in Baghdad, it was interesting. The morning started off with a series of bombings. In Baghdad, some people compared it to 2006 and some of the worst days of the conflict here. In Fallujah, there were about 20 explosions in all. And in the early morning of the voting, early hours, you actually didn't see all that many people going to the polls. Those numbers picked up, though, as the day progressed. And by midday and early afternoon, it was a striking scene in Fallujah, a place where people largely boycotted the vote in 2005. This time around, they were voting in numbers. And I think there was a sense among a lot of those voters in Fallujah and in other Sunni regions of the country that they were voting for survival in a way, that they had to have a voice in Baghdad as the country gets ready for what's going to be a very protracted negotiation over a new government.
Well, that's a significant shift, the Sunnis, in essence, having boycotted elections in the past. What changed?
You know, that's right. And I think, you know, early on in 2005, many Sunnis saw the new system basically set up by the Americans as one that had disenfranchised them. They didn't see that system as legitimate, and therefore they boycotted the election. I think one of the remarkable things you've seen over the past 4 or 5 years is buy-in by most of the groups, most of the parties, even most of the figures in this country into a system that many people still dispute, many people still resent the Americans very deeply, but also many people see that system as the arena in which they're going to try to fight their political battles.
Well, it's good that it shifts into the political realm. Let's talk about the election just a little bit. Are there any allegations of fraud? Was it a clean election?
You know, almost everyone expected, anyone you talk to in the street, and even candidates themselves, expected that fraud was going to happen. It's happened in past elections, and I think the sense was it's going to happen in this election again. I think the question most often asked here was how much fraud is going to happen. You know, one unsettling sign was that a main candidate, one of the most important candidates, Iyad Alawi, a former prime minister, went on TV last night saying that he did in fact believe that fraud had happened. How far he goes with those charges, I think, is going to affect the way the vote is seen, the way the election is seen. So far, we haven't heard overwhelming reports of fraud, but it's definitely out there.
All right, which says a little something about what lies ahead. Let's listen for a moment to the Defense Secretary, Robert Gates. He was speaking on his way to Kabul, and he was talking about the challenges for the Iraqi government that lie ahead.
Formation of a government's probably going to be complicated. And we hope it won't take too long, but it is such an amazing contrast to 3 years or so ago.
Well, Anthony, you've already talked about the contrast. Let's talk about the complications that lie ahead here. It's difficult to form coalitions in Iraq, isn't it?
You know, that's right. I think it's always something to remember when we talk about elections or even this notion of democracy in Iraq. The Americans have proved very successful in helping Iraqis organize elections. We saw them in 2005, we saw them in 2009, and we saw them yesterday as well. You know, that system, though, has proven much less successful in ruling the country. And you could argue that the governments that have followed each of these elections have largely been failures. Most people still complain about electricity, about services, about the wide-scale corruption that you see in governments, both on the national level and the provincial level. One of the things that underlies this is the idea that you have to find consensus given the divisions in Iraq. And it's a country right now that lacks a consensus. There just is no consensus here. So trying to form that consensus government in a country without consensus is going to prove one of the most difficult tasks.
Anthony, stay with us. I want to bring in Phoebe Marr. She is a scholar and historian and author of the book, The Modern History of Iraq. Phoebe, let's put this in perspective. You are telling us that this is the first election in 50 years in the Middle East that we haven't known the results before it happens. That's saying something.
Yes, it's an uncertain election. I haven't checked back on all the elections in the Middle East, but it's generally known the day before is going to win the day after. And the one thing to be said for this election in terms of being an actual expression of view is we're sitting here handicapping the results. We just don't know exactly how this is likely to come out, which says something for it.
All right, Phoebe, this sets the clock or starts the clock on the withdrawal of U.S. combat forces. What role does the U.S. play at this point?
Well, it plays, I think, an increasingly less of a role. Its muscle, of course, gets less. As we know, we're to have 50,000 there until the following year, and then all troops are said to be out. But I would like to put one caution in. If things don't go quite well, or violence tends to flare up, say, in the Kurdish area, we could possibly configure or slow down that withdrawal, although nothing at the present moment suggests that's going to happen. I personally think that there's a possibility after the election gets settled and a new government comes in that we may be actually asked to keep the small contingent there, because we're expected under the strategic agreement to be training, supplying, equipping. There'll be logistics and so forth for the Iraqis, and all of that might require some troops, not perhaps combat troops, on the ground. And, of course, we have a huge diplomatic mission, and the Iraqis are going to have to turn to us for a number of things, including the debt and elimination of many U.N. restrictions and so on. So there's still going to be, behind the scenes, a definite role for the United States, perhaps as a discreet mediator in some of these disputes.
Sounds like a lot to do. Phoebe, how important is this for the Obama administration? A lot of analysts saying this is make or break kind of thing.
No. I think we always like to take these elections, these steps, and make them absolutely decisive. Unless it breaks down, which, of course, we can go back and see it as a make or break, we should think of this as just yet another step on the way to where Iraq is going in the future.
Phoebe Maher, scholar and historian. Anthony Shadid, New York Times reporter. Thanks very much. It's 4:15. Let's check the headlines. Quarter past the hour. Let's check the headlines.
At least 50 people were killed when an earthquake hit eastern Turkey last night. Officials say the 6.6 magnitude quake struck when people were asleep and was followed by more than 40 aftershocks. Defense Secretary Robert Gates arrived on an unannounced visit to Afghanistan this morning. He'll meet with President Karzai and NATO commanders. He's there to review plans for the next big NATO offensive, which is expected in the province of Kandahar. Robert Gates has also been talking about yesterday's elections in Iraq. Speaking to reporters, he said the U.S. has come along way since the troop surge of 2007.
I don't think we could have written a script that, as from the vantage point of March 2007, to be where we are today.
Election officials in Iraq have begun counting the votes. First results are expected in the middle of this week.
In the corporate world, it's still a tough ladder to climb for mothers. A new study says women with children earn almost a third less than men and still face too many career obstacles. The study is from the International Trade Union Confederation. At the Oscars last night, The Hurt Locker clearly stole the show. The Iraq war drama won 6 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director for Kathryn Bigelow. In her acceptance speech, Bigelow dedicated the award to the men and women of the military.
And Sandra Bullock won Best Actress for playing a tough Southern mother in The Blind Side. She was enjoying her success last night at the Oscars. She also won Worst Actress in a Motion Picture in the Raspberries Award ceremony this year. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, we're going to recap last night's Academy Awards with our friend, TV blogger Delana Dixon. She'll join us in just a few minutes.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now let's take a look at some takeouts on stories we're following. And the big story from last night was the Oscars, the 82nd Annual Academy Awards last night. The show ran for 3 hours, 32 minutes, and attracted more than 3 million viewers. It was a big night for The Hurt Locker. That's a film about an Iraqi war bomb squad. It won Best Picture, beating out 9 other nominees. And it also won Best Director, the first time a woman has taken home that honor, Kathryn Bigelow. And also some other big winners from last night. Jeff Bridges finally won an Academy Award for his role in Crazy Heart. He was Best Actor. And Best Actress, Sandra Bullock, for her role in The Blind Side. We also got Christoph Waltz for Inglourious Basterds, Supporting Actor, and Monique in Precious took home the Supporting Actress Award. We're joined now to talk about the Academy Awards by TV blogger Delana Dixon. Good morning, Delana.
Good morning.
Long night for you.
It was a long night, up past 12, but I started my night at the Gilt in the New York Palace Hotel, where they were celebrating the Oscars here in New York, so it was pretty exciting.
Well, let's talk about the Oscars as a TV broadcast. One thing that people were really looking forward to was the co-hosting of Alec Baldwin and Steve Martin. Here they are.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am pleased to introduce actor, writer, musician, the Grammy and Emmy winner, one of the most enduring entertainers of all time, Mr. Steve Martin.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I actually enjoyed them. I mean, these guys have been in the business for a long time. They're both comedians. Seemed to me that they really bonded when they did the movie together. It's complicated, and I thought they had great chemistry. I thought their timing a little bit off, but it was fun, and they seemed to be having a good time. And really, isn't that what it's all about, just having fun at the Oscars?
I would hope so. The other thing we heard a lot about was the tactic to try and keep speeches short by having the winners do their thank yous off screen for an internet broadcast. How did that work out?
I think that for the people, we want to see people give their speeches, and I know they were trying to speed things up, but it didn't seem to help at all because the show still ran 3 hours and 32 minutes long. So if you're going to do anything, let them have their moment in front of all of us and say their speeches. So I don't know. I think that's still one up in the air.
What's the magic number they're looking for, Delana? 3 hours and 32 minutes is too long, we've heard. So what running time are they looking for?
You know what? I start to feel it at about the 2.5 mark, 2 hour and a 30-minute mark. So I think they need to figure out a way to kind of keep it right under 3 hours, 2 hours, 59 seconds, because by that last 3 hours, we're just checking out.
So, Delana, there's always a crowd favorite. There's always the person who won that touches everybody's hearts in the audience at the Oscars. Who was it last night?
Well, I definitely think that Monique was big last night, just saying how she was so glad that this film wasn't just about the politics, but about the performance. You definitely felt that she had a lot of gravitas behind what she was saying, so that was really exciting. And, of course, Jeff Bridges. He's been nominated 5 times, finally got an Oscar, and what did he say? He thanked his family for putting him in such a groovy profession, so you had to love that.
Well, he, of course, you know, has a pretty well-known family. The last question I want to ask you was about all the people who missed the first 20 minutes or so of the Oscars because of a dispute between ABC and Cablevision. That seems like a pretty big statement to make people miss the beginning of the Oscars because of a contract dispute.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because Cablevision just came off of their complications with HGTV and Food Network. So you would think that this is not the time that they'd want to get press. But luckily for Cablevision viewers, 20 minutes into the show, they announced across the screen for us who saw it that they were actually making an agreement right at that moment so they could get their Oscars. I mean, it only happens once a year, so we should be able to watch it.
Okay, friend of The Takeaway and TV blogger Delana Dixon, thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care.
For our next takeout, we're going to our listeners, and they are stepping out.
Last week, we told you about a competition in Atlanta in stepping.
That's a historically black performance art. It has deep roots in black fraternities and sororities. It goes all the way back to Africa. But a white team from an Arkansas sorority got rave reviews after their performance. And then the audience reaction changed when they won the whole thing.
They tallied the judges' scores up. They double-checked.
And this incident started a conversation that is ongoing with you about who owns culture.
Why do some feel the need to co-opt a culture that is not their own?
African Americans do not own step dancing any more than whites own golf or tennis or classical music.
You can learn more about this whole issue and actually watch videos of the competition at our website, thetakeaway.org. And you can also read some incredible comments from listeners like Black Feminista in Boston. She posts, "I don't believe in black racism toward whites. Racism is structural and institutional, and as far as I'm concerned, we still live in a white supremacist society. That being said, true, the white girls crossed a coveted boundary of a traditional black space, but I also noticed that all the sisters were flaunting straight or permed hair. So as Aretha would say, who's zooming who?"
My name is Leonard Middleton. I'm from Chicago. This is just reverse racism. All they want to do is put it where the white guy is always down. When's it going to stop?
A listener in Austin, Texas, posts to our site, "As someone who knows people from both teams and would actually consider someone from the white team a friend, I think they deserve the win 100%. With that, I don't think they deserve that scholarship money. Rare to find a girl in that sorority that works or has to worry about student loans. It is the whole reason I did not pledge while attending Arkansas, because I actually felt uncomfortable about the money. What's your take, and who owns culture? Share your view on our site, thetakeaway.org. As always, you can call us with anything that's on your mind by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And one thing we want you to weigh in on today is we're starting this new series about what makes a genius.
If you didn't have a little bit of the autism genes, you probably wouldn't have any musicians, artists, or scientists.
That's a renowned animal behaviorist, Temple Grandin. And how did people like her become so revered? We're going to explore the concept of genius all this week, and today we're talking about geniuses in our everyday lives. Tell us about a genius you've encountered and why you think they deserve the title genius. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. We're going to be checking in on this week's agenda in a moment.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Coming up in a moment, we're going to take you to Greece. We're going to take you to Iraq. We're going to take you to the Middle East. It's all on the agenda this week, and we'll check in on it in a moment. First, here's the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Defying a sustained barrage of mortars and rockets from insurgents, millions of Iraqis went to the polls yesterday to choose a new parliament. The first results are expected in a few days. U.S. troops are withdrawing from Haiti's capital of Port-au-Prince, almost 2 months after it was devastated by an earthquake. As the troops pack up, Haitians and some aid workers are wondering whether United Nations peacekeepers and local police will be able to maintain order. More than 500,000 homeless people still live in crowded encampments.
And here at home, you probably noticed that prices at the pump have been shooting up lately.
A national survey.
Well, you haven't?
I have noticed.
You have? Well, yeah, yeah. And in New Jersey, they pump the gas for you, too.
I know. But
yeah, isn't that nice? Anyway, a national survey says the average price of gasoline has risen 10 cents in the past 2 weeks. Let's check the markets. Asian markets are up. European indices are down. Futures down. The Dow gets underway at 10,566. S&P 1,138. NASDAQ 2,326. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Our government.
Comprehensive, meaningful reform.
Very difficult days ahead in Iraq.
A country that is of enormous geostrategic importance.
The Greek government.
The financial crisis is there.
Doing the work that needs to be done.
It's Monday morning, and we have a busy agenda this week, so let's get right to it with Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times. Also, Jonathan Marcus is with us, a diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Jonathan, let's go to you first and talk about Vice President Joe Biden. He has arrived in Israel. He's supposed to be speaking with Israeli leaders to talk about issues, everything from Iran to peace negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And he's also tried to repair relations between Israel and the United States. President Obama is suffering in Israel some of the lowest approval ratings for any U.S. president there. And in fact, Jonathan, we haven't seen a lot of movement from the Obama administration in the Middle East between Israel and Palestine, have we?
Well, we haven't. And I think that's one of the criticisms that many people have made of this administration, in a sense that there's been a little bit of an own goal. It started off very well with the president's Cairo speech, trying to have a reset relations with the Muslim world. That, of course, to an extent caused some unease in Israel. But, of course, what really stymied the peace process was this insistence on there being an Israeli settlement freeze. It had never been a condition for talks starting before. The Palestinian side rightly, I suppose, said that if the president wants this freeze, then that's a condition now for talks restarting. So in a sense, George Mitchell, the US envoy, has had to dig the administration out from under to get at least, we think, which will probably be announced today during the vice president's trip, an agreement for proximity talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians, not direct talks, but kind of a shuttle diplomacy, if you like, between them. Rather ridiculous when you think that Jerusalem and Ramallah are about 10 minutes up the road from each other. But that is a small step forward, not a great one.
Well, we did get, I guess, hopeful news from the Palestinians saying that they're willing to reopen these talks. That's good news, right?
Well, it is good news, but on the other hand, I think one has to be rather pragmatic about all of this. The situation in both the Palestinian camp and the Israeli camp is not at the moment terribly conducive to a peace deal. Indeed, there are many people who think that the idea of a two-state solution is rapidly running into the sands. There are people now proposing other ideas, some kind of large interim solution which would fall short of a final peace deal. Some people argue, certainly on the Israeli side, that that would be more realistic. But the real questions, I think, remain: how much ground are the Palestinian leadership, the Israeli leadership, prepared to give in search of some fundamental solution to this problem?
Okay, Marcus, let's come back to Washington here for a moment. Senator Chris Dodd is hoping to bring his financial reform bill onto the floor of the Senate this week. And here's what he had to say about it on Friday.
Congress and I, my view, and particularly this body, must pass comprehensive, meaningful reform of our financial system. And my hope and intention is to do everything I can in the waning days of my service after 30 years here to achieve that goal.
Well, first, let's talk about its chances to pass. Senator Dodd has been trying to collect votes in the interim time somewhere behind the scene. Do we have any idea whether or not this bill is supported?
Well, we think it will pass in the same way the jobs bill, after a great deal of drama, far more drama than should have been necessary because of, unfortunately, the kind of frozen politics, the bitter partisanship in Washington, it finally did pass. We expect the same thing will happen with the finance reform bill. The question is going to be, and as Dodd said, maybe this would have been better for health care if Senator Ted Kennedy had been alive. But as Dodd said, he's willing to end his service. Excuse me. He's really willing to end his service with getting this through, and he's willing to do everything he has to make sure this goes through. The amazing thing is, and again, I think it points to our politics more than the reality of the policies. The amazing thing is, after the worst financial catastrophe in history, at least in all of our lifetimes, we still have not gotten reform to make sure that doesn't happen again. It's kind of extraordinary, given how much the system almost went over the cliff, and how, in the end, the last administration and this administration rallied to save it, to do all necessary to save American capitalism, as it were, that we have not seen any type of reform that matches the magnitude of that crisis. It's kind of extraordinary.
Or that matches the public anger over it. You know, there's a couple provisions in this bill that have disappeared in backroom dealing. One of them would have made stockbrokers and insurance agents act in the best interest of their clients, as opposed to doing stuff to sell products that may not have made money for their clients. That is gone now. How
right.
important was it, and where did it go?
Well, for many, I think from a consumer point of view, it's incredibly important. And to think about the fact that, they're not working in your best interest, it's very odd. An extraordinary underline of the reality of the situation. But that is the reality of the situation. They are working for their employer, not for their clients. And that's not going to change.
And it's gone forever.
Yeah.
Oh, that provision. Okay, well, let's move on to Greece now. The Greek Prime Minister is supposed to meet with President Obama tomorrow in Washington. We know, of course, that Greece is embroiled in a major financial catastrophe right now, and they're struggling to get themselves out. So, first of all, if Greece defaults, how important this is for the United States?
Well, it's not terribly important for the United States, other than the fact that what we've seen, and we saw this with the subprime mortgage crisis here in the U.S., which became a global crisis. The problem is crises tend to become global. So this is not a direct issue with the U.S. It's much more of an issue for the Europeans, especially for those who use the euro currency, which was at one point flouted as a possible kind of alternative to the United States dollar as a global reserve currency. Well, right now, the euro's not looking so hot. Greece is not looking hot. As the Greek president meets with the president of the United States, he'll be meeting with the American president, but his audience will be much broader than that. It'll be really international investors and investors located here in the U.S., telling them that Greece is not going to default. If it were to default, that would be incredibly bad news for the euro, and it's some question about whether or not the euro would be able to survive that.
Marcus Mabry is the international business editor for our partner, the New York Times. Jonathan Marcus, one last quick question for you, because in response to some training exercises going on in South Korea with the U.S. troops involved, North Korea has put its army on full combat alert. Doesn't North Korea kind of do this a lot?
Well, it certainly saber-rattles a good deal and makes a great deal of noise. Obviously, diplomatically, all the efforts are at the moment to get the North Koreans back around the negotiating table in the so-called six-party talks, trying to negotiate away its nuclear activities. But, you know, these things are worrying. Clearly, incidents can occur, and there have been incidents between the North Koreans and the South Koreans in the past. So it's something to watch, but pretty much par for the course as far as the North Koreans, I think, are concerned.
Thanks. Jonathan Marcus is the diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC. And let's turn the agenda over to our listeners real quick. We're always interested in what is on your agenda for a week. Give us a call and let us know what your agenda is, what you look forward to, what do you keep on your schedule and keep your eye on. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up this hour, we're going to talk about family life. We do that every Monday. Today, how much of TV is too much for your kids? And can TV make your kids smarter, even if it's this?
Sunny day, sweep the clouds away.
Is educational TV really educating our kids? Let's talk about that more later in the show.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Miles O'Brien. John Hockenberry is traveling today. Can you live out without the internet for a whole week? Would you want to? If that fills you with horror, then spare a thought for two families in South Korea. South Korea, you may know, is the most wired nation in the world with the fastest broadband speeds and the highest percentage of people online. Our partner, the BBC, as part of a series on the power of the internet, asked one small apartment house to cut themselves off from the internet for a whole week. The BBC's John Sudworth had to persuade them to do it. He joins us now from Seoul. John, you were asking them to do a difficult thing, weren't you?
Well, that's right. As you mentioned, South Korea is often described as the most wired country on the planet. Its broadband speeds, as you've mentioned, are exceptionally high. That's thanks to a huge government effort investing in the infrastructure. They see it as extremely important for the country's future. And for many South Korean families now, the internet is a very integral part of many aspects of life. It's changing the way that South Koreans socialize, the way they consume, the way they shop, the way they communicate, of course. So to try to persuade any particular family to give it up for a week was no easy task. We targeted one particular tower block in central Seoul. We held a community meeting. We knocked on doors. Many people very reluctant, simply saying that the internet was too much a part of life now. Their children needed it to file homework assignments. Many people worked from home. They ran their own internet businesses. But at the end of a few weeks of cajoling and convincing, we found two families who were willing to take the plunge, the Kims and the Yangs, all of the members of whom were very heavy internet users, and they agreed to be disconnected for 7 days. And we stayed with them filming and recording to see what the results were.
And how did it go?
Well, I think many of our listeners would be able to guess some of the obvious effects. Of course, there were certain immediate practical inconveniences. Both of the families use the internet for their internet shopping. One family told us that she hadn't visited the local grocery store for anything other than fresh produce in at least a couple of years. So they were back out pushing the cart around the shopping aisles, having to do that kind of thing again. Socialization is another very interesting area. The family's very heavily connected, use the internet regularly to chat to friends and family in other parts of the country. And one of our mums, Mrs. Kim, runs an internet forum for other school mums. Now, she found an immediate practical inconvenience there, of course. She was having to once again arrange meetings in the real world over old-fashioned mobile telephone. They were having to meet in cafes. So there were these, if you like, minor inconveniences, which meant going back to a way of life that, of course, for many countries is still very much the present. But it was more than that. I think all the families found within a few days a major psychological shift as well. They felt simply cut off. They use the internet now for consuming news and information. Only about 30% of South Koreans receive a hard copy of a newspaper. The rest of them receive their news online. And a real feeling of disconnection and alienation living without it.
John Sudworth, thank you. That's an amazing experiment. We wish them well. Back with more.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Miles O'Brien and for John Hockenberry today. I'm here with Celeste Headlee. Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning.
Coming up, we'll talk about family life like we do every Monday. Today, how much TV is too much for kids, even if it's educational? More than you think. And we'll talk about it more in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on our leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. At least 11 people have been killed and more than 60 injured in an explosion at a government building in the Pakistani city of Lahore. It's the latest in a string of attacks against government and military installations. In Turkey, an earthquake has struck in the east of the country. Rescuers are working to pull people out of the rubble. Reports say an entire village has been destroyed. Associated Press says at least 60 have been killed.
In Iraq, votes are being counted after yesterday's elections. It'll be a few days before the first results are known. President Obama says Iraq still has a lot of work to do.
We will continue with the responsible removal of United States forces from Iraq. Indeed, for the first time in years, there are now fewer than 100,000 American troops serving in Iraq.
Later today, the president is going to Philadelphia, where he'll try to persuade the public to support his plan for health care reform. And a big night at the Oscars, of course. Last night, the movie Hurt Locker stole the show. The Iraq war drama won 6 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director for Catherine Bigelow. In her acceptance speech, Bigelow dedicated the award to the armed forces.
And I'd just like to dedicate this to the women and men in the military who risk their lives on a daily basis. They are there for us, and we're there for them.
Wasn't all smiles on Oscar night. That's because some people who wanted to watch it couldn't watch, at least for a while. If you lived in Brooklyn, you probably missed the beginning of the show. For more on that, we turn to Louise Story, business correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. So 3 million viewers, Louise, were unable to see the beginning of last night's ceremony. What happened?
That's right. There was a standoff between the Disney company, which owns ABC, and Cablevision, which is one of the main cable providers here in the New York area. And so until 8:44 last night, it was black. It was darked out, something that we normally doesn't happen with cable, but it's happening more and more. And behind the scenes, Disney and Cablevision were in fierce disputes. What's at issue here is that traditionally broadcast TV, stations like ABC, come free. The stations are not paid by the cable companies. The cable companies only pay for cable channels.
HBO and
Showtime. Right. But, you know, advertising is really dropping on these networks, and so they're looking for other ways to make money, and they want the cable companies to pay them. And so Disney was asking for $1 per subscriber from Cablevision. They settled on some amount lower than that, and apparently they're still in talks, but they brought it on just in time for people to see Penelope Cruz coming on stage to present the first award.
And are we expecting more of these disputes in the future?
We are. I mean, you remember around the turn of last year, we saw Time Warner got into a huge dispute with the News Corp, which owns Fox. That was threatening blackouts. Some people might also remember that the Scripps Networks, the Food Network, there was a blackout there for a little bit.
The Food Network.
And this August, Time Warner is coming up with Disney over ABC. And so this is probably a sign to us that Disney is going to take a tough line as they look for new revenue. And they will go as far as blackouts.
Okay, Louise Story is a business correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Those are some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
Pull out of the shadows and find that eventually. There we are, we are, and what we are is still family.
It's Monday, and here in The Takeaway, that means we talk family. Today, we talk about a topic on a lot of parents' minds. Do educational videos actually make your kids smarter, like a baby Einstein?
Refrigerator. Bowl. Cup.
I listen to those every morning. It helps me
do
out.
You?
Yeah, yeah. That's a clip from the Baby Einstein Wordsworth video. And based on a new study that came out last week, the answer is no. These videos don't make your kids smarter. Hmm. Are you surprised?
Not really, actually.
We have a lead researcher behind the study today with us. Her name is Dr. Rebecca Rickert. She is an assistant professor with the Department of Psychology at University of California, Riverside. Perry Klass is also with us. She is a primary care pediatrician and a writer for the Science Times. Let's begin with you, Dr. Rickert. Tell us about the study and your methodology. How did you determine it's not helpful to listen to these tapes?
Miles, the goal of our study was to examine whether children under two could learn specific words from a DVD like this. So what we did was we gave a group of infants between the ages of 12 and 24 months this particular DVD, which highlights words for common objects around the house, as you just heard. And we had children watch this DVD in their homes for about 6 weeks, and we brought them back to our research lab every 2 weeks to see whether they were learning the words from the DVD. We also had a control group of children who came by the same time interval every 2 weeks and were assessed on the same words. And essentially, we found no evidence of learning the specific words over those 6 weeks in the children who were watching the DVD.
So maybe parents should actually just talk to their children and they might learn a little something that way?
Well, one of the things we did find was that in the final visit to our lab, we had parents and children watching the DVD together. And in a scenario like that, when parents are doing what they would normally do to teach their children words, when they're pointing to maybe things on the screen, pointing out some of the objects to the children and encouraging them to try to repeat those words, in that case, then some of the younger children were learning words in that setting. So exactly, it continues to be important for parents to be interacting with their children while they're trying to teach them.
All right. Let's not just pick on one particular brand of disc or programming for kids. There's a lot of media that is targeted at very young children. I want to bring in Dr. Klass on this. First of all, let's listen to this Yo Gabba Gabba.
Yo Gabba Gabba!
Yeah, I guess if my kids were younger, I'd know that one. Do you have that? You're past that.
No,
you're past that stage, too. Dr. Klass, what about programs like this? Do they help?
You know, there's no evidence that for children up to the age of two that any kind of interaction with videos, with television, well, it's not an interaction, that watching videos or watching television helps, teaches them anything, does them any particular good. That is why a couple of years ago the American Academy of Pediatrics recommended no television, no videos, screen time
Nothing.
For children up to the age of two.
Wow. So, of course, parents use it as a babysitter. Bad idea?
You know, I think we're all trying very hard not to make parents feel terrible about the expedience that almost everyone resorts to. Sometimes, you know, for a couple of minutes here or a couple of minutes there. So if you're saying, has something bad happened if I, you know, went in to take a shower and my child wandered into the room and watched a little TV with his older brother, it's not about trying to make parents feel terrible about that. It's about saying this is not something you should be building in to a young child's day, not something you should be expecting a child under two or wanting a child under two to do a significant amount of, you know, minutes and quarter hours on end. And most especially, you shouldn't be kidding yourself that it's teaching the child something.
But what is a significant amount? I mean, one Blue's Clues show, is that too much?
The pediatricians are recommending that up to the age of two, children should not be sort of regularly building television screen time into their days.
All right. Well, Dr. Rickert, let's wrap this up. What are the shows? What are the things that you know, let's face it, parents are going to have their kids in front of television at some point or another. What should they be looking for?
Well, that's right, Miles. And again, I want to echo what Dr. Klass was discussing as well, that parents use these videos for a lot of reasons. So if and there's plenty of evidence to suggest that for older children, shows like Sesame Street or Mr. Rogers or other kinds of educational programming can be effective. But it is true that we're not seeing any evidence of learning from these kinds of videos when children are watching them on their own. So again, just echoing the importance for parents And remembering that the screen isn't replacing the importance of live social interaction, particularly for children at these young ages.
All right. Don't forget, you got to be a parent every now and then. Thank you very much, Dr. Rebecca Rickert, who is the lead researcher on that new study at UC Riverside, and Dr. Perry Klass, who is a professor of journalism and pediatrics. That's got to be one-off, journalism and pediatrics, to combine those two things. She writes a column 18 and under for the New York Times science section. Thank you both.
You can weigh in on anything you hear on the show, including that conversation, by going to our site, thetakeaway.org, or calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We have a new challenge for our listeners who are always pretty smart about this stuff. We asked you for the State of the Union in six words. Now we're asking you, what six words, or fewer, can be fewer, what six-word slogan would you want to see on a T-shirt? Anything. It can be about anything. Politics, world affairs, economy, whatever. If you're the winner, we're going to make new Takeaway T-shirts with your phrase on them.
Six words on anything.
Six words or less on anything.
So this is less than a
tweet. Just has to be a slogan.
A subtweet.
Yes. Submit your slogan to our website beginning April 8th. You can vote for your favorite at thetakeaway.org. And later this week, John is going to be co-hosting from Miami with our friends at WLRN. While he's there, we're working on a special project with the BBC 2 months after the Haiti earthquake. What does Haiti need right now? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Miles O'Brien, in for John Hockenberry.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.